From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, we're going to meet one candidate for Leland's Town Council and one for Board of Commissioners of Brunswick Regional Water and Sewer H2GO. You'll be able to ask your own question of those candidates later in this live Thursday edition. Each candidate will talk one-on-one with me today, answering my questions and yours. There are two ways to get your question in. Email us at coastline@whqr.org or call us at 910-343-1138. Bob Corriston joins us for segment two. He's running for Leland Town Council. Bill Beer is in segment three. He's running for H2GO's board. But first, we're going to take a closer look at municipal elections with a political scientist. Aaron King is an assistant professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Aaron King, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Some of your areas of expertise include American political institutions and political parties. We are smack in the middle of the 2017 municipal election season. And for many people, I think this doesn't even really feel like an election season, even though most people, those within an incorporated municipality, have people to choose for their local town boards and city councils. Why so little engagement relative to other elections?
Well, I think that there's always something political going on, and unfortunately, people have lives that they live, and sometimes politics are not always on the front burner. And when you do have so much attention brought forth in presidential election years, it's difficult to think about midterm elections. And then even at the local level, sometimes people just fail to understand the importance of what happens on the local issue. And even if they do understand what happens, again, they're very busy and their concerns might be elsewhere.
We've seen research that seems to say local elections have a much more direct impact on the quality of your life than larger elections, say at the state or federal level. Is that really true? I mean, when you look at this, when you compare, say, city council elections in Wilmington to the last presidential election in which, you know, we were looking down the barrel of selection of Supreme Court justices, does that still hold true?
Well, I think that this is something that I talk to my students quite frequently about. Many of us in terms of the political class, we live and die by elections, and particularly on the national level, and you see all the conflict that's going on now. And I really don't mean to diminish what happens at the national level, but I would like to say, compared to sometimes how we treat what happens at the national level as a life and death issue, it is, I think, worth saying how different that is than at the local scale. We think that everything that we do at the national level has such a great impact. And this is not to say that it doesn't, but in comparison to what we think and what it actually is very different at the local level, where people, myself included, may not pay that much attention to things, but we fail to realize how much actually matters on the local level and the immediate impact that we can have by showing up to vote in a municipal election.
Wait a minute, Aaron King, political scientist from UNCW. Did you just admit on the air, on an open mic, that you may not be completely in tune with what's happening at the local level?
I did, and I have no problem admitting that. And the reason that I say that is more to emphasize the point of even someone that is trained in political science with a PhD, granted my specialty is on the more national level and national level issues, but someone that is predisposed to be interested in this stuff, that has lived in this community now for 5 years, even someone like myself is probably not informed as I should be. And I'll even talk about your listeners. The people listening to this show are not the average Wilmington resident. The folks here are predisposed to know more about local issues as well. So at some point, we need to get to a broader audience to talk about just how important local elections is. Again, both you and I drove to work today, and we drove on roads, and we maybe dropped a kid off at school. And those are the sorts of things that matter in our day-to-day life. And again, I don't mean to diminish the important discussions and issues at the local level, but I also don't want to disregard the day-to-day things that affect our lives here in Wilmington.
You've mentioned roads. What are some of the other issues
that do come before local politicians that directly impact. Give us some specifics here. Why should I, as a recalcitrant voter or someone whose eyes just glaze over when we start talking about Leland Town Council or the H2GO Board of Commissioners or, oh my goodness, you know, Southport's Board of Aldermen?
Well, one of the things that's confusing is we do have a relatively complicated system of government. It's a federal system where the national level does some things, state level, local level. And even at the local level, you have things that the municipal folks deal with, and then you have things that the county level focuses on as well. But I think that local government is really the first and most immediate point of contact for voters. And whether it be issues like roads or planning, Even in this cycle, we're talking about things like the opioid epidemic and Gen X and the various statues that are going on around town and around the nation. These are things that are a concern at the local level, just like at the national level. And so it's really important for people to get engaged in local politics, one, because it matters, but also because it's very accessible. There's nothing that stops you from running into a city council candidate on the street. I just ran into one the other night, didn't even realize it until we started talking. But it's so much more accessible than at the larger level. So I think that people, if they really stop and think about it, there's really important issues that matter to your daily life, and there's things you can do about it.
The city council candidate, for instance, may not have, if that person winds up winning a seat, may not have any say over what happens with, say, Confederate statues, Confederate monuments in the state, because there is a state law governing that. But should that city council person still have a position on that issue? Is that something that local folks can still talk to that city council person about? Should they bother?
Again, I do think that our local representatives are the first point of contact. And, you know, no voter likes to hear, well, that's not my job. I don't need to worry about that. Certainly, your local officials are supposed to be a representative of you, both locally, but also they're your connection to the political world more broadly. And so technicalities of who's in charge of what law and who has jurisdiction in what area matter quite a bit less, particularly when we're thinking just about political engagement and what the voters actually want to see. Voters want to feel like their voices are heard, regardless of what's in someone's actual job description.
When you look at an issue like offshore drilling or seismic testing, there were a number of municipalities up and down the coast that passed resolutions in opposition to the idea of opening up the Mid-Atlantic region to that. Is that some, what kind of impact do resolutions like that have on policymaking?
I think sometimes even resolutions that may not have substantive consequences, it definitely voices the opinions of the local municipalities that people higher up the food chain in politics are certainly wise to heed. I mean, these issues are things that people feel very passionate about at the local level, but it is a smaller group of people that feel passionate at this level. They're different issues in local elections than they are at the federal elections. But importantly,
why should politicians farther up the food chain care about what, say, Curie Beach thinks about offshore drilling?
Well, I think this goes back to the relationship of, you know, in terms of national tax policy, there's probably some effect that I'll see next April. But in terms of my day-to-day life, I might not recognize it. But I know that everyone's thinking about drinking water in Wilmington. And so when it impacts someone's personal life on a daily basis, that's something that's going to get people really fired up to participate. And if people are fired up about those issues, they're much more likely to be engaged at issues, as you say, further up the food chain.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today with Aaron King, political scientist from the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, as we move through the 2017 municipal election season. This interview was pre-recorded, so we're not taking questions, but we do welcome your questions in the next two segments, which will be live on this Thursday. Segment two features Bob Corriston for Leland Town Council, and in segment three, we'll meet the final candidate for the H2GO Board of Commissioners, Bill Beer. The number to call on this Thursday is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Aaron King from UNCW. Most of these municipal elections we're looking at are nonpartisan. Can you explain what that actually means from a political scientist's point of view?
So people decry the political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats and different things that they stand for and the possibility of corruption and all sorts of the money that comes into politics. But political parties provide a very valuable service to voters, particularly voters that are not necessarily engaged. When your listeners or people on the street hear the word Republican or Democrat, that means something to them. It may not be factual, it may not be the truth about what it actually means, but people have strong opinions that help guide them in this complicated world of politics. And so in some ways, it's great that at the local level here, we have nonpartisan elections because it does force voters to think perhaps about the issues a little bit differently, to look at the candidates differently. But that's also asking a lot of the voters. The reason that you have 10.5% voter turnout is because it's difficult for people to learn what the candidates stand for. If we knew that certain candidates were Democrats or Republicans, that's a shortcut that really helps voters. And so it is nice that we have these municipal elections that are not necessarily connected to different elections, but at the same time, there are consequences to that.
And there are consequences, too, to just voting based on a party. And the first local consequence that comes to mind was, I think it was 2010. This is coming from memory, so forgive me if this isn't quite right. But in 2010, Brian Berger was elected to the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. And actually, that is a partisan race. But people chose him. It's largely assumed that he won because he was an R. And he wound up having lots of trouble in office. There may have been some mental health issues there, but it was a really rocky time for the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. And, you know, that was a direct consequence of people not finding out who they were voting for and voting for the party designation.
Well, I think as much as we support the broad ideas about a democracy, it's not a perfect system. Perhaps it would be perfect if everyone knew everything about every local candidate all the way up the food chain. At the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, do we value broad participation, even if it may be ill-informed? Or is it something that we only want a small segment of the population, which might not be representative of the broader population, really participating in these elections? So again, there can be consequences, both positive and negative.
So you threw out that number, 10.5%. You're talking about New Hanover County voter turnout, I believe, from 2015. Is that right?
Right. On my recollection of recent municipal elections, the number that I always throw out is 10.5%, 11%, something around there.
And I think that's about right for New Hanover County specifically 2 years ago. Some of our neighboring counties, like Brunswick and Pender, had voter turnout rates around 23 and 22%, respectively. What might account for the difference there? Are New Hanover County residents just kind of fat and happy right now, or what's going on?
I think that's a really interesting question. I'm not sure that I have a great answer for that. Part of me thinks that in terms of the population that lives here, perhaps New Hanover County is a little bit more of a diverse population in terms of where people are from and how long they've been here. Neighboring populations, they're probably a bit more stable in terms of who lives there and who participates in politics. I've always been self-conscious about the fact that I don't know as much about local politics as I would like. And I've been able to use that excuse in the past, but now I've lived here for 5 years, so it's probably about time. But as people move to a new area, as the population's changing, people do have a lot of things that they're concerned about, and sometimes local politics, rightly or wrongly, slips to the back burner.
So taking that idea of nonpartisan races and taking it past the election into the actual practice of governing and policymaking, does that make a difference? Does that change a dynamic on boards and commissions to not have official R's or D's or I's associated with people?
Well, I think that it does. Again, and there's positive and negative consequences to that. In some ways, it perhaps is freeing to politicians to not feel like they have to toe that party line. At the same time, I don't want to speak for any of the candidates, but I'm pretty sure that most of them would probably consider themselves to be a Republican or Democrat. So even in nonpartisan elections, that doesn't mean that you have nonpartisan individuals that are there. At the same time, I do think it's important to point out that some of the issues at the local level are not as cleanly partisan as some of the things we see at the national level. So that is one of the benefits that perhaps by having a party label not attached to the name, that people aren't necessarily making some of the incorrect connections between partisanship and local issues.
Are you seeing any kind of move in this state away from party affiliation, or what kinds of voter trends are you seeing?
Well, even at the national level, and I think that the local and state level are similar, we definitely see an increase in political independence. perhaps as partly because of the infighting in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, but people are increasingly identifying as political independents. At the same time, we know from decades of survey research that just because you say that you're an independent doesn't mean that you'll act like an independent. There are quite a few independents that if you push them in a survey question, well, do you tend to lean towards the Republican or the Democratic Party, that they definitely lean in one way or the other. So if you just ask between Democrats, Republicans, and independents, you're going to get about 35% to 40% of people saying they're independent. But once you include those independent leaners into the sample, the pure independents are about 10% of the population, and those are the people that are least likely to participate in the political process.
So we just have about 30 seconds left. Can you talk about the growth of the unaffiliated voter in the context of the increasing polarization in this country?
Sure. I mean, I think that politics is not something that people enjoy talking about. Politics and religion at the dinner table can really divide people, even people that are on perhaps the same partisan team of the Republicans or Democrats, the infighting in the Republican Party. Even Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders caused all sorts of conflict. So people shy away from these conversations that perhaps we really need to have.
Aaron King of UNCW, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. When we come back from this break, we'll meet our first candidate for Leland Town Council, Bob Corriston. You can call us during this live Thursday show with your questions at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The town of Leland is enjoying a period of explosive growth, which means town leaders must meet the need for infrastructure improvement while planning for the future when sometimes the data lags behind the reality. There are five candidates on the ballot for Leland's town council, not including the two candidates for mayor. Of those five, one person, Shirley Lawler, says she is not actively pursuing her campaign. Two of the remaining four are incumbents seeking re-election, and two are challengers. We met the two challengers and one incumbent on Wednesday's edition. Today, we meet the other incumbent. Leland Town Council members serve staggered four-year terms. Joining us now is Bob Corriston. He had a career as a salesman of office supplies. He's also owned his own office supply business. He's a current Leland Council member seeking his second term, and he is the town's liaison for economic development and the Leland Infrastructure Committee. In the past, he served on the town's planning board and was a liaison for the Parks and Recreation Department. Before that, he served as president of the Gardenwood Homeowners Association in Brunswick Forest. He's been a county committee man for the town of Nutley and Hasbrook Heights in New Jersey. He is also a member of the American Legion and Knights of Columbus. Bob Corriston, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you much, Rachel. I appreciate that. And I didn't realize you did all those things.
You've done a lot in your life,
yes,
sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. For God's blessing.
And you can ask your own question of Bob Corriston today by calling us at 910-343-1138 during this live Thursday edition. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Bob Corriston, you have a daughter who's married with children, and you had a son who passed away at just 15. And that awful tragedy became a motivator for you in a number of ways. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, it did. My son Douglas was a healthy 15-year-old, played football and basketball at high school. And one day he came home from school early, and he just didn't feel well. So my wife took care of him, what it may be. But the next morning, he still was feeling not good and took him to the doctor's office, who checked him out. And he said, well, it's like probably a case of the flu or something like that. And then he said he was tired a lot. So we were thinking mono, possibly mono or something like that. But the doctor didn't say anything. So after about 2 weeks, the same thing happened again to him. He fell into a way he was so tired and stuff like that. So we rushed him back to, took him back to the doctors, and the doctor said, well, I can't see anything, but what do you do, Douglas? And of course, our son Douglas was a typical teenager, and he spent a lot of time on the phone with his friends, and that's what happened, you know, some things like that, at 9, 10 o'clock at night when he should have been sleeping. But one night, we were going out to dinner with friends, and my in-laws were going to watch him. We didn't want to leave him alone, even though he was 15. And with that, he had gone up to the bathroom, and I heard a noise, and he had fallen in the bathroom on the floor. I go up there, and he was laughing. He said, I just can't stand up. So we put him in bed, and we said, we'll call the doctor and see what we can do. And he said, no, I'm feeling fine. I'm much better. So then my wife went downstairs to take care of some things, and I was downstairs. And then about 10 minutes later, I come in to check on him again, and he was breathing, but he was not waking up. And we said, there's something wrong. Call emergency, which we did. And with that, the emergency came, and they rushed him to the hospital. And 19 hours later, he died. And what he died for was leukemia, lymphoblastic leukemia, which now, thank God, is being cured. Really, is being cured, but on young people. But that's what he had. But what we did, we started a group for parents who have lost children, and through that group, have helped us heal by helping others heal. And the same thing has helped the people who run it now, because it's still going in New Jersey. But it's tremendous help for people who figure that there's no hope. No hope at all. In fact, that's what our group is called, Hope, Help Other Parents Endure.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much.
You parlayed that into a support group for parents. How does that play into your desire to serve on Leland's Town Council?
That's the thing is, my desire in my life, and I dedicate my life to my son too, is that just help people what problems they may have. People get so frustrated when they make a phone call. It's like all you get is customer service, and then they say, well, hold on or whatever. And that's no good. People should get answers to their questions. And I feel at the town of Leland, at least myself, and I'm sure all the council people feel the same way too, that we're there and they're our customers. They're the customer.
Leland is only 28 years old. That's pretty young for a municipality. And this means that this council and the next one will have a great deal of influence on the kind of town that Leland really grows into. What's the direction you'd like to go? And what are the risks, the potential pitfalls, if the wrong people lead that charge?
Well, exactly. Right now, the people who want to lead that charge are the people who will go back to the past. We're not going back to the past.
What does that mean, going back to the past?
We'll go back the way they are. In fact, I was at a meeting with the other candidates, and the question was asked by a gentleman in the audience, either give me a yes or a no answer. Do you think Leland should slow down the growth because it's moving too fast? And I said no, no, and no, no. We've got to continue moving forward. And the other three candidates, they all said yes, that we should slow down the growth. In fact, one was stumped and she couldn't know which way they'd go. I said, you can answer yes or no. You're forward, moving forward, and moving, staying where you are.
Well, when you talk about letting that growth go, I think part of the argument against it is unchecked growth leads to inadequate infrastructure. And we're seeing that now in mm-hmm. terms of, you know, the sewer problems that present themselves frequently in Magnolia Greens. And, you know, that's an infrastructure problem. You're on the infrastructure mm-hmm. committee. Mm-hmm. What's the solution to that? The DEQ says that they delivered recommendations to the town of Leland that really weren't followed. They don't sound very impressed with how the town of Leland has handled that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that like I said, the infrastructure problem, though we've had the rain like we've never had before, and that's one of the problems too.
That will continue.
And it will continue, but we've got to take care of that problem, and we are working on it. We've got a great Jim Strickland, who's the superintendent for that department, and he's doing working on the case. But it'll be taken care of because nothing's going to be held, you know. That's the thing is people say, we'll do it, it's going to be done. And that's one of the things, you look at my business card called Bob Corson's Done in One. And even when I ran for election the first time, it was called, I say, give no promises. I just give action. And people know that. Many people I meet in the street, unfortunately, I don't know their name. They know me from being in the town and doing what I'm doing, and they thank me for doing that there. So it's great, you know, to get that feeling from people that you're strangers and say, Bob, you're doing a great job.
In the Leland 2020 plan, one of the key principles is local character builds regional economies. You're also a liaison for the Economic Growth mm-hmm. Committee. So with Chick-fil-A, Panera Bread, national chains going up, how How do you characterize local character? What does that mean to you?
What do you mean by, I don't understand what you mean by local character.
Well, it's in the Leland 2020 plan, and it says local character builds regional economies. So that's my question for you. What is local character? What does that mean?
Well, I really, to be honest with you, I can't answer that question. I just don't know that.
Okay. Yeah, when you drive into the entrance to Leland, the first thing that really is part of that visual, you know, above ground power lines and a whole bunch of fast food restaurants and some kind of aging other buildings peppered around there. It's not very pretty.
I don't want to get in trouble again. So I did get in trouble when I was on the planning board before I became a councilman. And I said, I've got friends of mine when they come from north coming down to visit me in Leland. I said, don't get up at the first exit because you'll see the gas stations and restaurants like that. Continue down another couple of miles to Brunswick Forest. That's where I live. The next day, I was chastised by some of the locals. So the next council meeting, I went to the council meeting. I said, I humbly apologize. I was not offending anybody here. The people that live here are wonderful people. But it's not attractive when you just see you're a gas station stop off here. You're a stop off for a hot dog or a hamburger. That's who you are. I don't want to see that downtown Leland.
There's a lot more to Leland than that. And Leland residents know that. People who explore Leland know that. But you wouldn't know that just by driving into that first entrance.
Exactly. In fact, I spoke to the gentleman. We just came back last week from a conference of the League of Municipalities, which is all the mayors and councilmen throughout the state of North Carolina. And I spoke to Duke Energy. And I says, please, can you help us? We'll be happy to be a model. In other words, take those high tension wires down, overhead wires, put them under the ground so we can dress the town up. We want to dress that town up so when you come into Leland, you see flower baskets or hanging baskets up on the poles and stuff like that. You'll see a crosswalk in brick instead of the macadam or the asphalt. But we want to dress that whole downtown up there like that and attract people to come to Leland. There's so many things that, I mean, like I said, that I want to get done in town. And, well God, I'm sorry. I carry on. I'm so excited about my position and being involved with the town. And that's why 4 more years it'd be wonderful to get some of those other things done. And a lot of things did get done, I was part of, especially the new town hall. We have a brand new town hall where other people come to visit to use our town hall. We've got a senior center now, which just was built. The most important thing, as you probably might have read in the paper, is we just won the award for the Cultural Center, and that's exciting. The Leland Culture Center, the town of Leland won the top award. And I don't know if you've been there or not, but we have shows and many things like that. And I've been involved, like even bringing acts and things, like bringing different singers into the place and stuff like that. But it's exciting. It's exciting like that. If you don't mind me saying a couple of things, like I said, I would vision of once they have maybe like a little baseball stadium, 5,000 seat stadium.
You want to build a little baseball stadium? So that would be on the town's dime?
No, it would not be on the town's dime. It would be on the Atlanta Braves or Philadelphia Phillies or whatever baseball team wants, a minor league team.
To do that in Wilmington, and they wanted it to be on Wilmington's dime.
It wouldn't happen on Leland's dime. No, it wouldn't happen.
So why would they come to you if you wouldn't build them a stadium?
Well, they may come to us because they want to showcase their ball players and stuff like that in the southeast North Carolina. People don't realize how this area is growing. Like I said, you mentioned at the beginning, Rachel, we were a town of some 15 years ago. You wouldn't go to Leland. It's not a nice place to go. And that's what the word was always at. But now we're almost 20,000 people, the fastest growing community in southeast North Carolina. Besides that, one of the fastest growing communities in the state of North Carolina. So we're very proud of what we've done. And I'm a Lelander, and as I said before, I came from the north. I was a New Jersey guy. And I do have friends of mine say, well, we didn't do this way up there, and we didn't do that way. I said, you're in North Carolina now. And if you don't like it, unfortunate to say to you, 95 could bring you back. Really, and that's what I mean.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're meeting Bob Corriston right now. He's running for re-election on Leland's Town Council. In the past, Leland's Police Department has had some pretty intense struggles with turnover. And the Star News, at one point, I think it was published in 2014, did a kind of a recap of all the offenses. And we've got, you know, people getting fired after falsifying radar training records, resigning after reacting strongly to a Nevada officer stopping just inside Leland's town line. There was an incident when a female officer sued the town of Leland because her fellow officers shot her repeatedly in the groin during a training exercise. I mean, the list goes on. I could spend the rest of the segment just reading this list. Mm-hmm. How's the PD doing now?
We're doing excellent. Yes, I've heard that before I even arrived myself in Leland, how we had problems with our police department, and it was terrible. Now what we try to do, we try to meet with all the new recruits. Then they come on board, meet them, have them at a council meeting. But it's tremendous, great turnaround. I understand, like I said before, the way Leland was. But that was the old Leland. This is the new Leland.
Why is the police department different? What's changed?
Well, we've had a lot of new people came on board, and a lot of people left go. In fact, even the chief was let go.
Right.
So we did the right thing. The town manager, this council, did the right thing. What we did. That was before, basically, that was happening before I was on council. But it's a new Leland.
So let's talk about economic growth for a second. Leland has a population that has a higher than average educational level across all age groups, not just the influx of affluent retirees. So that should mean that Leland has a leg up when it comes to attracting businesses that offer higher paying jobs. But we're kind of seeing an explosion in the growth of the hospitality industry, tourism, that sort of thing, which aren't the higher paying jobs.
Right. Well, that's one thing. That's why I'd like to get something like a call center. Like a Verizon call center over in Wilmington, employing some 350 to 400 people.
Mm-hmm.
I would love that in Leland. I would love maybe an Amazon.
How would you attract that?
Well, we've got our economic developer, Gary Vidmar. We get in contact. It just matters kind of picking the phone up and find out who's the president of the company and go right to the top.
Would you call?
I would call anyone. I'll call any president. I'll call anyone. And I do that even when I travel. I go to places where some people work for big companies. Give them my card. Tell them to give us a shout. I mean, the beaches are here. It's a great community to be at. And I want to help us grow in some other than restaurants and stuff like that. And like we need a big thing like a call center or even a medical too. There's another thing too.
Bob Corriston, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Rachel. I really appreciate it. And a shout out to my Lelanders.
When we come back from this break, we'll meet Bill Beer, who's running for a seat on H2GO's Board of Commissioners. You can ask your own question of the candidates during the live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138, emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Brunswick Regional Water and Sewer, H2GO, popularly known as H2GO, is a water and sewer utility in Brunswick County that serves the northeast portion of the county, including Leland, Belleville, parts of Nevada, and some customers outside of these municipal boundaries. In total, it equates to slightly more than 10,000 water customers and nearly 6,000 sewer customers. Utility officials say they expect their customer base to double within the next quarter century. H2GO currently buys finished water from Brunswick County Public Utilities. And since 2011, H2GO has worked towards building its own reverse osmosis plant. Constructing a $30-plus million plant is controversial, with opponents concerned the project is not necessary and would saddle consumers with higher utility rates. Supporters say, especially in light of the recent discovery of decades-long contamination in the local drinking water supply, having an independent source of clean water is crucial. H2GO is governed by a 5-member Board of Commissioners who serve staggered 4-year terms. There are 3 open seats this year, 2 incumbents are seeking re-election. Joining us now is Bill Beer. He's been a resident of Leland for 5 years. Before moving to Brunswick County, he spent nearly 39 years with Betts Labs and GE Water in water treatment. During that time, he says he managed global technology development. Bill Beer served as chairman for the Water Treatment Committee International Water Conference and also the Cooling Technology Institute. He says he holds a number of water treatment patents and has published technical papers in professional journals. Bill Beer, welcome to Coastline.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
And you can ask your own question of Bill Beer on this live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Bill Beer, tell us about your professional background and what all that means. You say you've published technical papers. What has been the focus and in which journals?
Well, I've published in the Iron and Steel journals, Cooling Water Journal. I've co-authored sections of the Betts Handbook for Industrial Water Conditioning, and that is the preeminent source of water treatment technology out in the industry right now. Most of that work has been done. My papers that have been published have related to cooling water in industrial applications and commercial applications.
And does that relate to nuclear technology?
Oh, absolutely. I came down here originally on business in this area close to 40 years now, and worked with Progress Energy at the Southport Nuclear Plant, and principally in their cooling water area. So it's a critical cooling in the reactors and what have you. And those systems all require sophisticated type of treatment approaches.
So that is water treatment, but that's very different from treatment of a drinking water supply, is it not?
No doubt about it. My product line also included potable water treatment, and that involved corrosion inhibitors, disinfectants, and coagulant aids, all the different specialty chemicals that treatment plants use. GE Water was the world's leader in reverse osmosis technology as well. So some of those chemicals that were in the product line were used as service chemicals for reverse osmosis systems. And I participated in the design of several large systems in the United States, one of which was the world's largest system in Hama, Saudi Arabia.
And where do you stand on H2GO's construction of their reverse osmosis plant?
Where do I stand as far as their plant? Well, first, before I answer that question, let me get this out on the table right off the bat. I do not oppose H2GO.
The existence of H2GO.
H2GO as an organization, their staff is wonderful. They do a tremendous job maintaining distribution systems, doing what little wastewater treatment that they do. And the service that I've received personally from them has been terrific. I think their staff and the people there are just wonderful. So I don't have I want to get it straight. I don't oppose H2GO, which some people would have said. I oppose the project. And the principal reason why I oppose the
project. You oppose the construction,
of the
RO plant.
The RO project, exactly. And the reason for that is it's simply not needed. We have a utility in Brunswick County Public Utilities. We already have one. We don't need.
We don't have an RO plant.
We don't. We don't need an RO plant.
Okay. So the big looming question, the thing we haven't mentioned is GenX, this unregulated chemical compound that we understand is only a tiny component of this chemical compound cocktail that flows through the drinking water supply. So what do we do about that?
Okay, let me preface my answer with this. I don't have a problem with RO. Heck, I used to help market those things. And if through study it's determined that reverse osmosis is really the way to go, then it should be the county that builds it, not H2GO. H2GO doesn't have the experience. They've never made a drop of drinking water for anybody. The county has the critical mass, the economies of scale, to economically build a plant like that. They're the ones that should do it. If it's determined, that's the way to go.
So now, then Jane asks, well, if that's the answer, so you're talking about this idea of regionalism, this, you said, leveraging economies of scale.
Sure, absolutely. But getting back to your Gen X question, let's take a look at it, where it's at right now. Since Chemours has stopped discharging it, the levels have dropped below that which is used as a control in Europe. So it's around 16 to 20 parts per trillion.
That's Gen X.
And that's Gen X.
And that's a tiny component of what of the potential toxins that are in the water.
Absolutely. But you asked about Gen X.
Yes.
So when you talk about the other contaminants.
But that's a principle, though, because what it demonstrates the fact that this can happen.
Well, it's gotten all the press, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it's one of many contaminants that you find in drinking water. The authorities that control drinking water standards basically say the water coming out of the treatment plant that the counties produce, whether you're talking about Cape Fear Public Utilities or we're talking about Brunswick Public Utilities, is safe. And it's all about the low levels that are in there. We're still, regardless of whether you're talking about Gen X or any of the other perfluorocarbon compounds in the water, the determination's been made by federal government, state government, that this is safe to drink. Yes, it has. The governor was on TV not long ago with the state epidemiologist making the statement, the water is safe to drink. Now, look, you realize that some people are concerned about that regardless. They've been caught up with the news and what have you, and it's created some concern on people in people's minds. And they've made a public choice, a private choice, I'm sorry, a personal choice to not drink that water, to use bottled water. And that's fine.
Do you think it's hysteria? Do you, Bill Beer, personally think that the news treatment of the story about Gen X and those other chemical compounds that are unregulated, and so there isn't really an established health goal for a lot of these compounds yet. There mm-hmm. are no standards. Mm-hmm. So saying the water is safe to drink is different from saying we can't say that it's not safe to drink.
Well, in the world of science, you can't prove a negative.
Okay.
So you can't, you say, prove to me that it's not safe to drink.
My point is that they're unregulated because we don't have the science yet for a lot of these.
There are 70,000 compounds. 70,000 compounds. You can't test for them all. Okay. Based upon the information in the regulating authorities, the water as it currently is safe to drink. Now, as new chemicals are identified and come out, they should be handled as they come up. So, you can say, look, no water is perfectly clear or clean. There's always a contaminant in water. You know, if you're willing to measure it to the parts per trillion, you're going to find something, okay? And I don't know if many people understand what a part per trillion really means. Rachel, I don't know if you know what it means, but I try to put it in terms of a shot of whiskey or a shot of vodka. And you put that shot of vodka in a million tanker cars, a train tanker car, that's a part per trillion. A million tanker cars, a shot of vodka. That doesn't make a martini.
So okay. Is it a fair characterization then of what you're saying to say that all of the news coverage about these unregulated and emerging chemical compounds has generated hysteria? It sounds like you don't think that the level of public discussion that we're having about it and the public concern over the water supply is really warranted given the reality.
I don't think that's completely fair. I think it's warranted to have discussion. And look, nobody wants these chemicals in there. I don't want them in there. And the people who are discharging them should stop. Okay? Having said that, I'm also very aware of what the law says. So there are elements in the Clean Water Act and the discharge permits that allow them to discharge certain things. As these new chemicals emerge and are identified, then we should handle those things as they come one by one. But until such time that it's determined that your water's not safe to drink, I'm drinking it, my wife drinks it, when my kids come to visit, they drink it. That's where I'm at right now on this thing.
And do you have any filtration systems in your house,
no.
in your own?
No.
So you drink it as it comes out of the tap?
Absolutely. Except for maybe the refrigerator has a filter in it that came with it. I don't, I'm probably not too diligent in changing that out. But,
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today we're meeting Bill Beer, who's seeking a seat on H2GO's Board of Commissioners. You have just a few minutes left to ask your own question on this live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. James writes, the EPA, the NIH, and the CDC have all issued health advisories for synthetic compounds like Gen X. Plus, the dioxin in the water is carcinogenic. These compounds are particularly detrimental to children and women of childbearing age. Wouldn't it be judicious, writes James, to use a readily available pristine water source that does not contain any of these contaminants? What's your answer to James?
Okay.
Yes.
I didn't realize that was a question, so excuse me. First of all, no water source is pristine. The water source that is going to go through the reverse osmosis, the proposed plant, is salt water. It's pretty crummy water, and the only way to clean it up is with a reverse osmosis plant.
Are you talking about water coming out of the river or water coming from the aquifer?
The aquifer.
That's briny.
That's briny. That's the well water that they're going down 600 feet to get that water.
So despite what we've heard from other candidates, you can't just dip a cup into that water and drink it.
Oh, no. No, it would hurt you if you did that. But interesting point about this reverse osmosis plant, and a lot of people don't talk about it, is the wastewater. For every 4 gallons you make, you discharge a gallon and 0.2 or 1.2 gallons of wastewater. And, oh, by the way, that wastewater has radioactive elements in it. And one of the reasons why their discharge permit is under litigation right now is because of that. So, there's a price to pay, when you do anything, when you're treating water. I'm not saying that you don't have waste from traditional water treatment methods, but it's much lowers a percentage of the water you're making.
One candidate who supports this RO plant mm-hmm. said that the wastewater would just go right back into the river, it would be the same concentration of salinity. And it's like pouring pasta water back into pasta water.
Well, that's if you mix it. And what they're doing is they're counting on the fact they're going to use the river to dilute down that salt water to a lower level. So, okay, I guess you're calling that the solution to pollution is dilution, okay? And the law, the same law that allows them to make that claim allows Chemours to discharge their chemicals in the water as well.
Okay, Bill Beer, just a minute left. Tell us, let's say you're elected, we're getting to the end of your 4-year term. What has happened? What has changed because of your presence on the board?
Well, one thing that's changed is we're going to take a close look at affordability. Affordability is a key factor. The area that we're on, that we live in, is 15% below the poverty level. So what we're going to have is we're going to have an affordability index with our water and protect the people who can't afford to buy the water.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Bill Beer, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rachel. It was a pleasure being here.
Pleasure having you here. Thanks also to Bob Corriston and Aaron King. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.